sufferers who, though they were from the same town, might as well have lived on different worlds, and yet both had great reason for fear and despair right now, and it was belief in Jesus that made the difference for them.
You'll want to be sure to catch the rest of Pastor Terry's message in just a moment. But first, we want to thank you for tuning in to the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast with pastor and author Terry Bailey. This broadcast is also produced as a free podcast, which you can find on iTunes or become a subscriber through our website. We'll have more information at the end of the broadcast, but for right now, let's join Pastor Terry as he preaches this insightful message.
In the old saw, one man challenges another to a fight, and the man who has been challenged responds to the man who has challenged him, "Mister, I've whipped tougher men than you just to get to a fight." Hang on to that for a moment. I have a reason for saying it. And then a little bit from the lyrics of a Whitney Houston song. And I'll tell you that I'm the first person to acknowledge that Whitney Houston was a messed up individual and to acknowledge that there is no other kind of individual. But she got it pretty nearly right with this one. "Many nights we prayed with no proof anyone could hear. In our hearts, a hope for a song we barely understood. Now we are not afraid, although we know there's much to fear. We were moving mountains long before we knew we could. There can be miracles when you believe. Though hope is frail, it's hard to kill. Who knows what miracles you can achieve? You will when you believe." Jesus, in the passage that Jim read for us, and it was a long passage, I know, 2 weeks running for long passages, and the problem here is that there are two stories in this passage, but they just about have to be considered together, and I will tell you that that also gives me license to preach a long sermon. So, settle in. Jesus has just left, as he was invited to leave. And there is a caution here. If you invite him firmly enough to leave, he may. He has just left, according to the invitation, the area of the Decapolis where he had healed the Gadarene demoniac. He and the apostles got into Peter's boat. They sailed from the southeast corner of the Sea of Galilee across to the northwestern shore. The name of the town is not mentioned. It is generally presumed it is Capernaum. That is important, if correct, for reasons that I hope will become obvious as we go on. I believe it probably is Capernaum, and the two things happen here. One, the woman with the issue of blood is healed. Two, Jairus, the leader of the synagogue's daughter, dies and is raised from the dead. Let us do our best to understand the two situations. To be the ruler of a Jewish synagogue in the first century was a big deal and a much coveted position. The position came with a salary usually well above a general working man's wages. And if the assumption is correct, and this is the Capernaum synagogue, which was particularly large and prosperous, then well above a working man's wages. And in a large synagogue, the synagogue administrator, ruler, would also have a budget which he managed, oversaw for cleaning and repairs and maintenance and the purchasing of scrolls of scripture if there was really a lot of money for doing such things. In a very small synagogue, the ruler might himself be janitor and fix-it guy and everything else. But in a large synagogue like Capernaum, there would have been funds under the ruler's administration to hire out such services. It would also be his prerogative to decide Who would say the prayers? Who would lead the psalms? Who would comment on a chosen text or to invite visiting rabbis or dignitaries to speak if they thought it was appropriate on whatever the text of the day was? Jairus then would be something of a big deal in town. Most likely, he was a Pharisee, almost a given for the position. And even if he was not, all the most wealthy and influential members of the synagogue that he led would be Pharisees, which is to say that the people upon whom his large salary and prestigious position depended were the Pharisees of his town, quite likely his fellow Pharisees in town. And if this is Capernaum, and shortly I'll quit saying if, you've all got the point that it's an assumption, and just start saying that it is, because that's what I think. But if this is Capernaum, what you need to understand for sure is that the Pharisees of Capernaum have met Jesus before. Way back in Mark chapter 1, which I realize is only four chapters ago, but for us in real terms, that's 8 months ago. Way back in Mark chapter 1, we find, according to the account, that Jesus was teaching and healing and casting out demons in Capernaum. And on the Sabbath day, he went into the synagogue and he taught there, which would mean he had been invited to speak that morning on the say-so of the ruler of the synagogue of Capernaum. And this is just a few months past. There he delivered one man from demonic possession, and upon leaving the synagogue service, Mark says immediately, we should take that as right outside the door of the synagogue, he began to heal people of their various diseases and conditions. And then he left and carried on his ministry in other towns. And after a little while, he came back to Capernaum for the second time. And when he got there, he found the Pharisees of Capernaum ready and waiting for him. They had been offended by him. They regarded him as a competitor for the affections of the people and the terms of the covenant under which they thought everyone should labor. And they were ready for Jesus, and they criticized every little thing that he'd... Your apostles, they should have washed their hands. You can't heal people today. Today is the Sabbath day. Healing people today would violate the work laws. And on it goes. And then, as per chapter 3, Jesus enters the Capernaum synagogue again. Afterwards, he does some more healings. And he says to the folks in the crowd some things that are kind of calculated to be point to the Pharisees of Capernaum. And they took the point. And they were really upset because despite all their protests, those protests mainly designed to keep the people away from Jesus, despite all their protests, the crowds kept flocking to Jesus. And then it says in Mark 3:6, Pharisees of Capernaum went out and began to conspire with their natural enemies, the Herodians, as to how they might destroy Jesus. The word is specific. You should read it. How they might accomplish the death of Jesus. So yes, the Pharisees of Capernaum have met Jesus before, and there is no love lost. And Jairus is the guy who first extended the invitation for Jesus to speak in their synagogue, and Jairus' large salary and prestigious position depend on maintaining the goodwill of those Pharisees, of which he is probably one, who hate Jesus with a hatred unto death. And you put all this on one side of the scale. Money. Influence, social inclusion. And there's only one thing on the other side of the scale. Jairus' little girl. is dying. She is almost gone. His little 12-year-old daughter. And Jairus runs to Jesus. And this wealthy, influential man throws himself at the rabbi's feet and begs for his help. You know, you can be on whatever side of however severe disagreements, and at the end of whatever length of bad history. But if your little girl is dying, let's just take a poll. How many of us would swallow our pride and even risk our position if we could save our little girl? Of course. Jairus runs to Jesus. Now you have this other woman. She has had constant menstrual bleeding for 12 years, or, as it turns out, since the year Jairus' daughter was born. Call it a coincidence. I just throw it out there. There are some traditional things about that I would be glad to share with you later. I got to cut material somewhere, but I'd be glad to share those things with you later. This woman's condition is also a big deal. It is a big deal in the opposite direction of Jairus' big deal. Jairus' big deal made him at least moderately wealthy. This woman is poor because she has spent everything she had seeking a cure for her condition and only gotten worse. The text says she endured much at the hands of the physicians. I did a little research. The cures recommended at the time included the drinking of extremely unpleasant and often somewhat toxic concoctions. It included being burnt in an effort to cauterize, to stop the flow of blood. And the less said about this in specifics, the better. But understand the nature of her illness and think about cauterization in the first century. She had endured much at the hand of the physician. Some of it was just silly stuff, I guess. You took the egg of an ostrich and you burnt it down to ashes and you wrapped it in a linen rag in the summer or a cotton rag in the winter and carried it around on your sash. And some of it was silly. Some of it was unpleasant. Some of it was painful. Some of it was risky unto death. But she had tried it all. Until she ran out of money to try further. And only gotten worse. Jairus' big deal was a matter of social inclusion in the inner circles of power. This woman's big deal rendered her continually, ceremonially unclean. Jairus was the ruler of the synagogue. This woman would not have been allowed to pass the doors to enter the synagogue at any time in the last 12 years or since Jairus's daughter was born. If she had a husband, she would not have been allowed to have normal relations with him or even to sleep in the same room with him because of her uncleanness. She would have been excluded from almost every aspect of social life important to a woman of the time and place because of her condition. She was unclean and no one could touch her without becoming unclean themselves. She could not cook for any family she had because she was unclean and could not touch food which they were going to eat. If she had a son and the son was 12, she would not be able to attend the son's bar mitzvah or to hug him at home afterwards or anything else because she was unclean. Her big deal had reduced her life to misery and loneliness and penury. But she had heard about Jesus. Who in Capernaum had not? Jesus had been there twice before. And both times he healed a lot of people. And he was back. And he got off the boat and was immediately surrounded by this woman's fellow townsfolk, none of whom she was supposed to touch because of her uncleanness, but they were packed around Jesus. Yet maybe there was a way he could get his attention. He could come aside. He could help her. Only Jairus, the big deal Jairus, shows up. He falls at Jesus' feet and he explains his situation, and Jesus is leaving with Jairus. And you know, the last two times he just left town like that, and he may leave town again, and he may never come back. Or maybe she just reaches out and touches the hem of his garment. And her bleeding, which had gone on for 12 years and cost her everything and rendered her almost as great an outcast as if she had been a leper, just stopped. Next part is also interesting, but I have to pass over it quickly. I'll give you this much. It is my reason for including that thing about, "Mister, I've whipped bigger men than you to get to a fight," so you can make the connections. Jesus feels power go forth from him and stops to ask, "Who touched me?" And understand, this woman under no circumstances was supposed to have touched him. She was unclean. He was a rabbi. "Don't do this." "Who touched me?" Did he know? Was this just some minor thing? Because, I mean, her situation was bad, but death is death. I don't remember the name of the show. We watched a few episodes of some doctor hospital show once with a little Korean doctor who didn't speak English very well. And I remember a couple consulting with him about the wife's problems, and they said, "Well, what's the worst case scenario?" And he glowered at them and shouted, "Death! Death always worst case scenario!" Is this just some comparatively minor incident that has to be dealt with as an interruption before Jesus can get on to the real thing of bringing a little girl back from the dead? Or is there a connection? Jesus asked, "Who touched me?" And the apostles are dumbfounded. You see this crowd, right? I mean, you see these people who are mobbing in on all sides of us until we can just barely walk. And you want to know who touched you? Really? Jesus identifies the woman who touched him, who should never have touched him, and points her out. And she is scared spitless. Because maybe, after all, she has just made Jesus mad with her unauthorized, ceremonially defiled imposition. And if the person that you just ticked off is the kind of person who can heal diseases with a word or less, has that kind of power, what might they do to you if you have angered them It's a fair question. The wrath of God should not be lightly incurred. But Jesus says to her, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace," which is to say, "I'm not mad at you," "and be healed of your affliction," which is to say, "No takebacks." And as those words leave Jesus' mouth, people arrive from Jairus' home with the news that his daughter has died. No need to trouble the rabbi anymore. I hear in that line shadows of what I've already alluded to, that Jairus was making an unpopular and probably costly decision in going to Jesus, the sworn enemy of his fellows and patrons. I mean, it's really sad that the little girl died, but at least now you don't have to go through with this foolish decision. You just walk away before more harm is done. No need to bring the rabbi into the house paid for by his enemies. And Jesus says to Jairus, "Do not be afraid any longer. Only believe." Any longer? Jairus, apparently, was afraid. Had been afraid for a good while, which is completely understandable. And maybe there is this too. Did you ever get into a position where all the things you were afraid were going to happen have already happened? Never asked this question out loud, by the way. But what else could happen? All the things I was afraid. Maybe that's in there too. Because his daughter is dead. And he may already have cost himself his position and his income for no benefit. And Jesus says, "Give up being afraid. Only believe." He doesn't make any other promise at the moment. But Jairus knows what he has just witnessed, and they go on to his house, which is full of mourners. Which is another thing we need to pause to understand. The mourners did not show up in the last 5 minutes while Jairus was out. They were already there. They had been there all along. They were there when Jairus left to get Jesus. Everyone knew the girl was dying. They had not known, by the way, much in advance that Jesus was coming. It wasn't the kind of thing we're used to today where you send promotional posters in advance and buy time on radio stations and such as that. He just got in the boat and came, and he showed up, and he was there. And everyone remembered how many healings he'd done the last time, but that he left with lots of sick people still clamoring for their turn that they never got. And maybe now it's going to be their turn. And Jairus thinks, maybe it's going to be my turn. And by whatever means the news reached him, he ran from his house already filled with mourners about the bed of his dying daughter. And we should also understand that not all the mourners were family. Some of them were professional mourners, which is a strange notion to you and I, but common then and still common in some places today. Without going into the cultural background and reasons, they hired mourners to gather around the bed of the dying and lift up weeping and wailing. And the professional mourners were good at it. They didn't need to know you particularly. They didn't need to have any strong emotional attachment to you. They were really good at whipping up the weeping and wailing on demand. And Jairus ran out on the whole big weeping, wailing, moaning affair because there might be this one last hope. The circumstances make it certain in my mind that this decision he made all at once. And now he returns with Jesus, and the girl is already dead, and the mourners are at fever pitch and top volume. And Jesus says, "What's all this commotion for? She's only asleep." And the mourners laugh him to scorn. I mean, they do this for a living. They have been at the bedside of the dying before. Death is their business. And they know dead. And this girl is dead. Silly rabbi. Tricks are for... Never mind. The mourners knew dead when they saw it. That Jesus is life. They didn't know that. And he tells the little girl to get up. And she gets up. And everyone is astounded, as they ought to be. After all, they know death. We all know more than we would like about death. We have plenty sufficient experience with death. We understand what it looks like. We understand the havoc that it wreaks. We know that it is inevitable, and we get it that in terms of this present existence, it is also, sadly, pretty final. We know all that. Sometimes I think that we are only just beginning to understand what it means when we say that Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. Now, I need to make a point here, and I need it to be understood in that I am not even this much backing away from what happened in this passage or denying the import of it. But I need it to be understood, this little girl would die again. Her father, Jairus, would die. All the professional mourners would, in the normal course of events, have to have professional mourners hired for them, because they would die. The woman with the issue of blood, whomever she was, would die. Pharisees would die. Everyone in Capernaum that day, whether they had been healed on one of Jesus' three visits or not, would die. They have all been dead for a long time now. Jesus did not on this occasion undo or alter in the slightest the 100% mortality rate of humankind. However many people he healed in Capernaum, however many times he visited, this visit would still leave people behind who did not get their turn, and Jesus made no secret of that whole thing. These spot healings were only what they were. They were not the thing. They were only signs to point people to the thing. The thing was always to undo death completely by breaking the power of sin which causes it, and that would be accomplished by entirely other means. But for this moment, this present testimony, two poor sufferers who, though they were from the same town, might as well have lived on different worlds, and yet both had great reason for fear and despair right now, and it was belief in Jesus that made the difference for them. Don't be afraid any longer. Only believe. I've just said goodbye recently to my father, and I know that I am not the first in this room to have that experience and will not be the last. In quiet moments, when I am alone, I still weep. But I can say this, I am not afraid. I believe. Death, loss of life, or continuing misery under crushing, tragic circumstances. It's all right here in 20 little verses, the fifth chapter of the Gospel according to Mark, whichever or whatever besets you. Don't be afraid any longer. Only believe. The word is the same for the people of Capernaum who were not healed that day or any day. The word is the same for all those houses filled with mourners into which Jesus did not enter at that time. But he gave us these signs through these two people who still must die, as we all must, but who at the hours of their eventual death surely knew that there is this God who is life. And if you believe in him, even if you die, yet shall you live. Be afraid no longer. Only believe.
We want to take a moment to thank all of you, our listeners, for setting aside time each week for the Indian Run Christian Church broadcast on this station. You can find out more about the church with a quick visit to our website at www.christforeastcanton.com. On behalf of Pastor Terry and all the folks at Indian Run Christian Church, I pray God's blessing on you and your family.